This is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cuska, sports director for Civic Media. Right now, we're airing a Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks game over the air, but due to our rights agreements, we're not able to stream those games here. Civic Media might be a newer company, but we are dedicated to providing the best in sports coverage. Our team has decades of experience covering sports right here in Wisconsin. We've got Mike Clemens, who covers our state's biggest teams on location and does daily updates on all of our Civic Media stations statewide. Many of our stations have local reporters dedicated to teams in their area, covering their community dozens or even hundreds of times each year. No matter where you're at in Wisconsin, we are committed to covering sports, especially in the communities that our stations serve. And we put all of our local coverage right here on our stream, so you can go ahead and grab the free Civic Media app so you never miss a game at civicmedia.us/app. You can find the game you're looking for over the air, or you can stay tuned right here on the stream for more news, talk, and conversation. Thank you for listening to Civic Media from all of us here on the sports team.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. Wisconsin has one of the higher closure rates in the U.S. for charter schools. A new report lays out the challenges. Here's Mike Moen.
Charter schools, which receive public funding but are often run by private entities, are billed as alternative learning environments for families who feel they need more options. But the new findings show nationally, more than a quarter of them close by year five, with rates worsening over time. Wisconsin is among the states with a closure rate of at least 45%. Jenny Hofschulte of the Wisconsin Public Education Network says families enrolled are less scrambling when a charter school abruptly closes.
That's 45% of those families put into a lurch and having to make pivots and new choices for their children.
The report from the National Center for Charter School Accountability cites low enrollment, along with fraud and mismanagement, as the top factors behind the closures. Backers of charters say despite these issues, these schools are sometimes still the best options in underserved areas. Hofschulte acknowledges some families might be happy with their charter school, but adds the push to authorize these sites over time ignores the root issues that hinder educational outcomes.
When you look at student outcomes, like, poverty plays the biggest role in it, but we're not talking about how to address poverty in communities. We're saying, like, well, it must be the public school system, so we'll do this other thing. You know, a charter will be better.
The Milwaukee public school system recently dealt with a financial scandal. Hofschulte says that shouldn't be taken lightly, but she suggests those examples are scrutinized more than the shortcomings of charter schools. According to state data, Wisconsin currently has 226 charter schools in operation. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Had an interesting encounter, ran into somebody who we kind of used to butt heads back in the day. A guy who was the person on election night 2016 who said to me, it's going to be interesting watching liberals become states' rights people as Trump uses the federal government against the people. It's going to be interesting watching how the dynamics shift. And he was right. And, you know, this is a person we have had throughout the years, lots of headbutting, lots of back and forth, lots of, you know, debates. And look, spirited debates. But at the end, slapped each other on the back, shook hands, I'll buy you the next round kind of a relationship. Somehow in the Trump, post-Trump era, that has broken off. And the conversation that just happened is, it was about why. And because I asked him, I said, you know, because he saw me, he came up, he said, hey, I'm sorry to hear about what happened to Carol, you know, whatever I can do. And in this moment of tragedy, and again, this is when we came back to do the show, I said, you know, I want to live in this world where we're nicer to each other. And because of what we're living through, And because of my wife's injuries and where the family is right now, we've gotten a lot of love, a lot of support. And I want to thank everyone who has sent cards, emails, DMs, all of that, and well wishes and thoughts and prayers and vibes and all of that. Thank you. But, you know, people that I haven't talked to in a while have reached out. Hey, how you doing? You know, clearly concerned for we as people. Not our politics, not who we're going to vote for. They know who we're going to vote for. But that kind of community again. And I've been grateful for that because, you know, it gives me faith that maybe there is hope down the road. Maybe at some point we can put aside these differences. But, you know, we began having this kind of like old times discussion about how we got here. And the how we got here is kind of important. Because I have my view, and that is the moneyed interest have spent an awful lot of resource in being in our ear and reinforcing the message that liberals and Democrats are the enemy. Not just wrong, not just bad on policy, but the enemy, the demonizing, the idea that they have to be destroyed, crushed, eliminated. That's different than, I disagree with your policy. I want to vote you out. And we kind of agreed on that, but we really agreed on the point that, and I've been saying this for years. So to have him go, yeah, I think you're probably right. We've turned our society into one of a Hunger Games scenario. We're living out kind of the Hunger Games to where if we lose a job, we know we're in real trouble and there isn't a helping hand. Unemployment replaces a very small amount of the income that you lose. The health benefits you lose, you generally don't get back. Generally, when you lose a job, it takes years to catch back up and your standard of living, your livelihood gets worse, your family condition gets worse, stress levels go up, all of the negatives, all in the pursuit of more profit for a handful. And our tax code, I said, you know, and this is where we disagreed. I think our tax code has an awful lot to do with this by rewarding the ones at the top who are able to control all of the media and the strings and the jobs and all of that for their own benefit. But it's this Hunger Games kind of scenario where if you win, I lose, or if I win, you lose. So there's this fight and there's this fertile ground for the... Well, the chaos merchants, the people who just want to cause division, there's fertile ground for that. And we see that in our immigration discussions. You know, the immigration discussions that we're having on the Donald Trump side of the equation are horribly inhumane. It is not who we are as a people. It's not who we've ever been. But there's always been that thread. And Trump has just magnified that. And our media structure has done a poor job of reporting on any of this. The fact that they're talking about getting a giant bus and rounding up the others and re-migrating them is quite remarkable. And that isn't the end of him politically. Quite remarkable. The fact that, you know, here's a guy who, you know, waxing poetic with the richest man in the world about firing striking workers who are looking for maybe a 50-cent an hour raise or maybe a little bit better health benefits or maybe a little bit better retirement security. I mean, I'm not talking a lot, I'm talking a little. And waxing poetic about how wonderful it is to fire those people. And that's not the end of him. Is quite remarkable. The stunt at McDonald's, which, you know, we both kind of just shook our head and go, I don't know. Who advises that? And truth of the matter is we're in a weird moment. And this is where I come back to, I want to go back to the days where we argued over policy. I want to go back to the days where I argue that you're wrong, not that you're my enemy. And that's a huge difference. You know, you go back to the Reagan era, you know, hooray for me, the heck with everyone else. The one who dies with the most toys wins. Greed is good. Well, we're living the final stages of that ideology. The greed the giant sucking of wealth to the top. Not trickle down, but flushing up is what we've lived through. And families are struggling. So understand, when inflation goes up, families are struggling. It's harder to put food on the table. It's harder to put gas in the tank. It's harder to make sure that the kids have sugar and shoes and all of the things that they need. Life gets harder. Stresses happen. And in those moments, we look for some help. And this is where, as a believer in government and government doing the things that we need done collectively, that we can't do individual, that's where my belief in government is. And I look at this moment, and while the two of us still disagree on the candidate, because he has this major libertarian bent of government should do nothing, should be not involved in my lives, I should be the final arbiter of everything that happens to me. I get it, but it's a fantasy. Where I'm at in this position of, we're all in this together. He wants no taxes. I think we need a much higher tax rate. Because taxes, that's the cost of admission into a functional society. That's the cost of admission into this wonderful experiment of self-governance. And that's the experiment, self-governance. How are we going to govern our land? Not, hey, some invisible thing is gonna push us around. So for me, again, it was an interesting conversation. We've promised to perhaps do it again, because we walked away and we smiled, we shook hands, and hey, I hope to see you again. It was kind of like old times, and it kind of gives me hope that maybe we can get back to that. That maybe, you know, we can disagree and still be friends. We can disagree and still be neighbors. The person who lives across the street from me, a wonderful, wonderful guy. His wife, a wonderful person. And yet they've got Trump signs in the front yard. I struggle with that. But at the end of the day, it's still, we have to figure out how we're going to exist together. And I think policy-wise, it's got to come back to where we're demanding the same things in the same arena. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, New Hampshire State Senator Lou D'Alessandro is going to be here to share some of his wealth of knowledge. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So days are ticking down to that Tuesday in November, the deciding day, where we decide whether we're going to have sanity in the White House or, well, 4 years of the Twitter Tiberius. The hope is we make the right choice, but here to share some thoughts on maybe how we get to that right choice and maybe how we got here, because that keeps popping up. How did we get to this moment where someone who lies constantly talks about other people's stuff, how they're even in this? That's the amazing part to me. That's why I've asked Lou D'Alessandro to come talk with us. Lou is a New Hampshire state senator. He's been representing the 20th district there for, well, a long, long time, which is why they call him the Lion of the Senate. He's also written the book, The Lion of the New Hampshire Senate and Thoughts for Presidential Hopefuls, back in 2018. Lou, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick. Pleasure to be with you. And listen, no more critical time in the history of our country than this 2 weeks coming up. Let me tell you, this election is a big, big deal. I've been a part of a lot of elections in my lifetime, but this one is the most significant one. You know, we say that all the time, but I really mean it on this one.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, you've been at this a long time.
Yes.
Why is this one different? Define it for us. You know, because we've heard it for past elections. Why is this one so different in your mind?
I think this one's different because we have a totally incompetent individual who, in my opinion, is not all there, running for the presidency of the United States. A person who for 4 years was the president and who damaged this country to the point where it was almost not retrievable. That's one candidate for the presidency of the United States. And that just drives me crazy. And we have Kamala Harris, who's the vice president of the United States, who's really come around in the last 6 or 8 months to be a very formidable, impressive candidate for the presidency of the United States and an opportunity to be the first woman president of the United States. I was a strong supporter of Hillary Clinton, spent a lot of time with Hillary over her time running and traveled around the country for her. I thought she was the right person at the right time. We didn't quite make it. We made the popular vote, but missed the Electoral College. Kamala has a chance to be that person this time. It's a battle, I'll tell you, it's a battle. And when you think of the things that come out of Trump's mouth over this campaign, you say to yourself, is that a normal human being who's using that kind of language, those kind of slurs, both racial slurs and just vulgarity? That's just not part, that's not part of the process. I've been in this business a long time.
It's not part of the historical process. But what do you say to the person who goes, but Lou, that's how you know his supporters talk. That's what they believe. He's just giving the people what they want.
Well, I say if that's what the case is, then we're all in big trouble, because that isn't, in my opinion, that isn't what the people want. The people want the truth. They want the truth, and they want to know how they can best be served. That's what people crave. They crave answers to their questions. They want solutions to their problems. And they want people who can lead them down that path. And certainly Donald Trump is not that guy. I think the Harris campaign is clearly and succinctly articulating a roadmap to progress, a roadmap to making their lives better. And what more does an individual want than an opportunity to make their lives better? They'll work hard. They want to work hard. They want a job, and they want a home. They most people want a family. They want to take care of those people in the best way they can.
Yeah.
And they want opportunity.
No, I argue the same thing. Look, I think we all red hat, blue hat, no hat. I think we all basically want the same things. You know, good jobs that we can support our family with, good schools for our children, safe neighborhoods, opportunity, a future, you know, all of those things. But sadly, over the past several decades, our politics have gotten much more harsh. The consequences are much greater. And look, you've been around a couple of days.
Yes.
You've watched this transition happen.
Right.
From when the jobs that you do were respected to now,
yes,
where you're just a no good, dirty, well, I can't say the rest.
But
that's how. Okay, we'll go with that.
Yeah, right.
But that's how our politics have transpired over the last couple of decades. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts why.
Well, I think there's been a deterioration in the mores and the folkways of our society. Look at what's disappeared. In many instances, the family, the basic unit of society, has dissipated. A lot of problems. Mental health problems among young and middle-aged and older people. Mental health problems have personified themselves. I got an award last night from the Mental Health Center of Manchester because of the work I've done with regard to mental health. That's a problem. And look at what's basically happened to the world and the the chaos and confusion around the world. We're witnessing a war in the Ukraine. We're witnessing an uproar in the Middle East. These are things that we've never seen before. This generation has never seen any of those things before. I grew up during World War II. I mean, I was a baby, but indeed, my grammar school career was seeing, you know, hearing nightly news. Didn't have television in those days. Can you believe that? Didn't have television. I remember having to go to the grocery store with ration stamps to get food. So I have witnessed some of the most moving times in history, some of the best times in the history of the world. We won the Second World War. This was the most wonderful period after the war. Success for everyone. The GI Bill, get a home, get a vehicle, progress, get a job. And all of a sudden, that's deteriorated.
Right.
And people have come to one conclusion, Rick, and this bothers me terribly. The hate that has been festering in our society. It's there, and people have lost faith.
Yeah.
They've lost faith in themselves, but they've lost faith in the principles of our society. The kids that go to school, they worry about what's going to happen there. People are worried about their job. They're worried about this. They're worried about that. They don't take into consideration appreciation of the good things they have. We all dwell on the negative. And I think that's been the characteristic that Trump has brought to the scene over the last 10 plus years.
Yeah, I don't think that's new. I think he's highlighted it. I think
he's manifested it.
I think he's absolutely, I think he's made hay on it, but I think and that's been there for a while. I would argue, you know, you said, you know, as my grandparents' generation, maybe the generation just a little bit older than you, came back from World War II after beating fascism overseas. They came home and built what was the most prosperous working class in the history of humanity. And they did that through joining and forming unions and demanding a fairer share of the wealth that their labor created.
Exactly.
I would argue the reason I think, at least my thought, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, I think the reason that we're in the position we're in is we've now been put into this Hunger Games kind of scenario where if you win, I have to lose.
Right.
And this kind of situation where if you do better, I have to do worse. Whereas my grandparents' generation, your age and a little bit older maybe, they said that we could all do better. When we all do better, we all do better instead of I win, you lose.
Right. I think you've just put it in a great way. That's the exact way. If I do better, you do better. People don't believe that anymore. They think if I do better, you do worse. We have been fed that nonsense over and over again. And it is nonsense. Look at the labor unions have done great things for us. They've restored, they created the ability to get a fair wage, to get good working conditions. All of those made life better for everybody. Not only those in the labor union, but those outside of the labor union. They took advantage of it. Health benefits, retirement benefits. All of these things mean so much to us. And yet people have, they don't share the positives, Rick. They don't share the positives. They don't tell people, listen, I've got a damn good here and I want to help other people make it good. And the only way I can do that is to spread the word that, hey, we got good things happening here, and stay with it.
Yeah. No, this is where I've said I think Joe Biden's administration has been transformational. We're moving away from a lot of the neoliberalism that caused a lot of this Hunger Games scenario. We're talking about strengthening unions, we're reshoring manufacturing to give communities an opportunity to grow together instead of being ripped apart. There seems to be that kind of, and I think it's because of Joe Biden's age. I think it's because of, quite frankly, your age as well, that you remember when we were a community. My generation grew up believing, hooray for me, and the, you know, the heck with you. The one who dies with the most toys wins. Greed is good. We were the Reagan era.
Right.
So I think we're still suffering from that Reagan hangover.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And Biden has restored our faith. I think given us some things to cling to, given us some things to grow with. And Joe Biden did some wonderful things. Look, he got Congress to do some great stuff. And Congress, you know, they were a pain in the neck. I'll tell you, I think the Speaker of the House needs help.
Yeah.
He needs a lot of help.
He needs a different job that doesn't have Speaker in front of him.
He's got to go back to Louisiana and open up a pharmacy or something, because he needs a lot of help. He needs a lot of help.
No, and the reality is, I think Joe Biden will be remembered as one of the top 10 best presidents in the history of this country in just one term.
Yeah, a transformational president, no question about it. No question about it. And the thing that Joe Biden gave us is hope. He restored hope. And he said, as he made his decision not to run again, look, the country is more important than me. This country and what's going to happen in this country is more important than any individual.
Yeah.
And that's key. That's what makes life worthwhile, because you're doing something for somebody else. And you're trying to make the lives of other people better. And that's what politics should be all about. But indeed, that's what life should be all about. My commitment is to make life better for the people I serve, for my neighbors, my friends, and those who come in contact with me. I want to be perceived as that kind of person who, when you need help, I'm there. And I think that Joe Biden has personified that it throughout his life as a senator, as the vice president, and as a president. And let me tell you something. We're going to win this election, and we're going to keep going on that path, and we're going to restore the faith that people have lost in our government, in our society, and in life itself. People have lost that will to move forward. We're going to restore that.
Do you think it's possible? I mean,
given
how divided we are, given how bad our media structure is, owned by billionaires like Elon Musk, 80% of everything we see, hear, or read owned by a handful, four or five corporations at this point. You know, we're being fed not only misinformation and disinformation, but wrong information. I mean, you talk about the economy. The economy is, by historic terms, is doing really well. And yet you ask the majority of people if the economy is on the right track. And universally, people are saying no.
Because they're fed that nonsense. And as you say, that they believe it, because we tend to believe the negative because we don't want to accept the positive.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the tragedies that's happened in politics. People have tended to believe that. We got to restore. You know, we got to reinvigorate the negative. We got to eliminate the positive. We got to eliminate the negative and hang on to the positive. And we can do it, and we will do it.
No. Kamala Harris is the person that you think. Because look, I remember the Obama years, and look, the hope and change. Yes. Everyone bought the hope and change, and I got to be honest with you, I didn't get it. I didn't get the hope and change. It didn't really happen. I think Obama was a good president. He could have been a great president.
Could have been.
I thought Joe Biden did exactly what the country needed in the exact moment he did it. He brought that calm, steady leadership, didn't get involved in all kinds of chaos. And in the moment that the country, you know, needed him to make a decision to step aside, he made that for the betterment of the country, not for himself. True selfless acts. Can Kamala Harris pick this up in as divided as a country we are and unite us again?
Sure. Look at the best comes out in people when the pressure's on. They do their best. They make good decisions, and they lead. That's kind of, think of the points of society when decisions had to be made. Think about Eisenhower and the decision to invade Normandy. That decision turned the course of history. We won the war because of that. Think of great decisions that have been made in the past. Formative decisions, the Churchillian methodology of compromise, all of these things, hallmarks in history, decisions that change the world. And look, it's here.
Yeah.
It's here, no, and we have an opportunity. And when it's up, when you have opportunity, carpe diem, seize the day.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, we're living history, and you know, I tell my kids this all the time. You're going to tell your children and your grandchildren that you were here for this moment, And I hope we make the right choice in November so that we can have a nation worth passing on to my great, my grandchildren and great grandchildren. Last question I've got for you. You know, New Hampshire, the last couple of times I've been there, it's been kind of butting heads. Are we seeing New Hampshire going which way this November?
New Hampshire will go blue. It will go for Harris, for sure. And I think we have a lot of enthusiasm. We've got people working hard. And it's going to go blue. And I bleed blue and white. So let me tell you something. We're going blue in this election. Harris will win. And hopefully we will bring more and better things to the American public.
Amen.
We're going to do better. And we're going to have a great, great American day. A great American day.
Good stuff. Lou D'Alessandro, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Hey, it's been an honor and a pleasure to be with you. Stay happy, stay healthy, keep the dream alive and well. Have a great, great, great American day, and stay in touch.
There you go. Will do. Thanks, Lou. Lou D'Alessandro, New Hampshire State Senator. Want to hear your thoughts. Is he right? Do we only focus on the negative? Should we maybe, I don't know, spending a little more time on the blessings and the good things that are in our lives? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
We're airing a game right now, but stay here on the stream for more civic media news, talk, and more.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete civic media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
This Civic Media station is currently broadcasting the Packers, Badgers, Brewers, or Bucks over the air. Due to streaming restrictions, we can't provide you the broadcast here. You can find an affiliated station at civicmedia.us to find the game over the air. We'll also have updates on the game and the biggest sports news from Mike Clemens daily on Civic Media stations all across Wisconsin.
Matt Nair on Air.
Vice President and Director of Marketing for Versity, Gretchen Jameson, is with us.
When you donate blood, there's a couple of different products, if you will, that your blood can produce. There's whole blood. You can do platelets every 2 weeks. You can be a double red, which is what you do.
Yes. For me personally, whatever I can do to maximize my gift, as you say, is worth it.
You can go to Versity.org and take a look at all the different ways to donate and give.
Matt Nair on Air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I've been waiting to get my next guest on the program because I saw a couple of days ago had a kind of a big event. Had a major textile manufacturer, the U.S. Trade Representative, some people that I really respect in the economic world all together for a little powwow talking about the American manufacturing, bringing jobs back, what that could look like. And that's why I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come share some thoughts. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is so great to be with you. Thank you.
So big shindig you had here recently with the trade representative, Catherine Tai. This Baron Winthrop, from the American Giant, mm-hmm. Heather Boucher, a friend of the show, kind of a big deal.
Yeah. It was, look, anytime you can have a cabinet official at your office for an event, it's a big deal, right? I mean, I'm not gonna say pretend like it wasn't. Yeah, that was the honor of the year for us, I think, and Catherine Tai's my all-time favorite trade ambassador. She's just so spectacular, and has really put policy behind the words worker-centered trade policy. And so this particular event I thought was interesting because it was like basically a case study in how you can bring jobs or industries back that once disappeared, that people devalued, if you have the right policy, and if you have entrepreneurs, Rick, who have the right intent. And I think that's important too, because so many of them just don't think about producing in the United States of America. But when you start with that intent, you can do it. And you can do it well. I mean, this American Giant, and some of your listeners may be familiar with them. I mean, they do, they started with hoodies, and they expanded out from there, and they make a lot of different knit and woven goods today. They restarted basically 100% American flannel shirt production, which unbelievably had completely disappeared from the United. What's more American than flannel, right? I mean, and somehow that disappeared too. But Byard Winthrop, you know, he was basically like, I am going to do this 100% made, American made, from the cotton to the zippers to when we get the yarn to when we do the cutting and sewing and the dyeing and you know, all of that. And so 100% of it is made in the United States. And their hoodie has been called, you know, the best damn hoodie ever made, actually. And it's like you buy one and you hang on to it for longer than you might own your car, really.
Well, it's like how we used to feel about our jeans in the old days.
Yeah, it is. And it keeps getting better. You know, it gets softer like every year. It is so great. But the thing about Byard, he's like, you know, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he can be cynical about politics, rightly so, because people talk a good game, but then they don't follow through. And so when he sees like an effort that really is aimed at bringing supply chains back, you know, he's all on board. And so it was fun to have him share his story and his journey. And he's someone I've known now for probably 7 or 8 years. And his company's been around for about 13 or 14 years. And the trade ambassador who has been to some of his facilities in a supply chain around the country to talk about what is possible and, you know, why policy really does matter here. Yeah. For firms that want to reshore the work or compete against textiles and garments coming from countries like China.
Yeah, because ultimately you do have to have, you know, a sound policy and smart investment and all of that thing. But you have to have people, you know, clearly like this Winthrop guy who wants to do things here. And it's not only about the profit, because in textiles, you know, the profit clearly going to be made somewhere in Southeast Asia by, you know, people, you know, working for poverty wages.
Yeah.
So to want to do that here, that's kind of a big freaking deal. And it's an old school kind of mentality. I think of my uncle who, you know, years ago, you know, back in the early 60s, started a business, built it into a major powerhouse business. Mm-hmm. But every one of his employees, he knew their names, he knew their wives, he knew their kids, you know, he showed up to their events, you know, all of this. He was part of their family. And to him, they were his family. But, you know, as the kids took over, not so much. And that's how the country, I think, is gone. It's, you know, it's not the business of the golden era of America. It's all about the greenbacks.
Yeah, and Byard was someone who was in finance, and then he was in supply chains and worked for global company, right? Or like, you know, was involved with this whole process. And so he saw the other side of it too, right? He saw the other side of it. And so when he had the opportunity to start up his own idea here, he was like, this is the only way I'm going to do it. The only way I'm going to do it is if it is 100% American made, because I know it means quality. I know it means jobs. I know it means we're not selling our country out, and I'm going to be able to deliver it. And is it easy? No, it's not going to be easy. Is it going to be a quick, cheap dollar to make for me? No, it's not. It's going to take some time. But we're going to deliver a product. And to his credit, it paid off. I mean, he shared this, and this to me is unbelievable, that he was speaking on a podcast and he was kind of like dissing Walmart. Okay. You know, and just saying, you know, we probably don't agree on much, but boy, would I love to, you know, partner with them, because they're, you know, they're the largest bricks and mortar retailer that we have. And this is the thing. So they called him up. They heard this. They called him up and they said, let's get a deal. And so they made a deal to sell American Giant t-shirts for under $13 a pop at about 1,700 Walmart stores, you know, and I was blown away, you know, by that as well. And so, you know, even and I, you know, Walmart, and believe me, we have criticized them many, many times. But, you know, they have a Made in America program that they've established. They reach out to entrepreneurs. And could they be doing better in a lot of other things? Yeah, absolutely they could. But that Made in America program, you know, I wish Target had that. I yeah. wish, you know, all these other retailers had it too.
So I got to tell you though, Scott, so, I'm hoping that's not the kiss of the devil. I'm hoping in another year or two, you don't come back and go, you know, we talked about this well, because you know, this is how it starts. You want to get your stuff into our thing. You got, and then they keep squeezing you and squeezing you and squeezing you until, well, China, here you come.
Well, right. And you know, the way, and look, I don't pretend like I know Walmart at all. I'm going to be very clear about this. And he's like, look, they have a new leadership there. They're committed to this program. They're still going to do what they're going to do, right? And they're still going to do some of that, but they're deeply committed to try to do some of this domestic sourcing. And so, look, the proof is the fact that his t-shirts are in their stores, right? And they are 100% made in America. And so I'm like, okay, right? You that's right. And I don't think he's the kind of guy that's ever going to take that stuff overseas. He is just not, he would shut it down before that happened. So it's interesting to see if we're on the cusp of something that's kind of cool, right? That we've rediscovered this with policy, that entrepreneurs have kind of rediscovered how to build these supply chains in the United States, and that retailers, probably to get some customers in their doors, understand the appeal of Made in America too.
So I was just going to say, I haven't been in a Walmart in 28 years. I haven't been in a Walmart in 28 years.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, maybe at some point you go, hey, I need one of those American Made t-shirts. It might get me in the door.
Yeah. 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 And it's like, you know, it's like, I just, you know, I'm going to, you know, when I see them doing stuff that I don't like, I'm going to criticize them. But I also think that, they deserve some props for this, because no one else was going to do it. They did it. So good for them. Good for them. But it does. I mean, Rick, to the larger point, it shows what's possible. If you have the policy, if you have the entrepreneurs, you know, if you have a great product, that you can make this stuff in the United States. And so it kind of burns me up. And this is like, you know, and I want to make clear, we don't endorse candidates here. But so when you hear politicians talking about Made in America all the time, and then whether it's their Bibles or in the past their ties or whatever, that they choose to make them in China, or I mean, that's like, that to me is super hypocritical.
Yeah. No, without question. Which was going to bring me to the guy with the Bibles and the tennis shoes and the water and the steaks and the vodka and all that, because you know he's running around saying tariffs on everything. We're going to slap tariffs on everything, and everybody else is going to pay our bills. And look, I'm not an anti-tariff guy. I've got a lot of people who are emailing me going, I'm 100% against any tariffs. Tariffs are all bad. It's all terrible. We can't do any of this. And I'm going, no, I mean, a blind squirrel finds a nut occasionally, but you got to have a policy with it. It's got to be strategic. I'm not anti-tariff, but I'm against, you know, broad brush blanket tariffs that would raise the cost of everything. So in this scenario where we're starting to see this growth of textile manufacturing, some could argue, would a tariff not be helpful? Or is this somewhere where you see... I should ask, what do you see with that?
Yeah, that is a great question. And I mean, we've talked about tariffs a lot, and I think we both support the strategic smart use of tariffs, both to fight against unfair trade practices from countries like China, and also to help buffer against overcapacity globally, and to help industries start up in the United States, right? Those seem like really logical uses for tariffs. Now, completely redesigning the revenue system in the United States to go back to something where you're collecting a lot of revenue through tariffs and you're promising everybody else a tax cut. I don't know how well thought through that is. I think it's a lot of talking points. And just like everything, I mean, if we go back to Trump's, you know, the term he had from, you know, 2017 to 2021, you know, he talked a lot about tariffs. And yes, he put in some tariffs on steel and aluminum and then on some other Chinese products. He stopped that and made a deal with China where they would buy a certain amount of American products and we would stop putting tariffs on their goods. And China never bought those products, basically. They never came through. And this is what I guess this is what, you know, I think people should know, is that the Biden-Harris administration kept virtually all of the tariffs that the Trump administration put into place. And not only that, they put new tariffs on EVs that might be coming from China, or they raised them on batteries and other sorts of PPE that are made in China so that we can start up those industries in the United States. And, you know, Biden negotiated exactly zero free trade agreements during his term, Biden-Harris. And, you know, and so it's like, I mean, pretending like you're going to do all this wonderful stuff with tariffs without a very specific plan, I think is just, you know, he's trying to do a sales job. He's trying to do a sales job. Yeah. And it's not also, the other thing about it, Rick, it's not backstopped with the investments you need to make in your own economy to make it productive, efficient, and competitive. And that is what I think this administration has done a pretty good job of, with semiconductors, starting with clean energy, and also with infrastructure and broadband and all of that. And so you can, if you just do the one thing, it's not going to work particularly well. You got to have kind of the whole package, the strategy, if you will, the whole policy, instead of like just a talking point.
Yeah, well, ultimately, it's easier to sell a single bullet theory than it is a much more complicated, hard to sure. to get out kind of policy, especially when all you have is a what was the phrase he used? A concept of a policy. Because you're right, I don't think he really understands what a tariff is, because yeah. Look, the consumer does eventually pay it. Now, the employer, you know, the company could absorb some of the cost, but ultimately mm-hmm. it does get passed on, and I'm okay with that when we're talking yeah. about protecting, industries of national interest. And I think, yeah. you know, the reality is we can do that and still have sane, rational trade policies and still compete in those markets. I think you have to deal with the fact that China cheats.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is a really good point where, he did put tariffs on steel and aluminum, but the untold part of that is that those tariffs, when all is said and done, because there were a lot of exemptions and exclusions that he made to that, maybe applied to 40% of those imports, 40%, not 100% of those imports, maybe 40%.
Yeah.
And so again, you hype this up and you talk this big game and the reality is something different. And then, you know, so Biden-Harris administration keeps the tariffs in place, then adds all this new investments. And so you have record factory construction happening in the United States.
No, it's incredible. I mean, because I see all this stuff going on. I see the press releases. I see the job numbers. And yet, you know, the polling, you ask, you know, someone walking around the street, the economy's terrible. Everyone's, you know, thinks that it's horrible and the sky's falling, because it's what we're being sold because of someone like Trump, who just gets so much media attention and sucks the oxygen out of the room. And is nothing but a purveyor of horrible. I think that's a huge part of where we are.
Yeah, I think you're right. The nonpartisan silver lining I'm going to take from all of this, though, is there is a competition now to see who can be better for yeah. factory jobs and who can have a better trade policy, as opposed to the past when it was like, whether it was McCain or Romney saying we got to be free trade, and Obama kind of going halfsies, or Clinton saying those jobs aren't coming back, or whatever, you know, we're in a different era now. And so I'm going to celebrate that part, but we also have to have real policy. It's got to be more than slogan.
Amen. And right now I'm going to go to American-Giant.com and I'm going to look at those hoodies.
All right. They need some planned obsolescence though, because I've had one for like 12 years and it's still awesome. I was like, I want to buy another one, but
trust me,
how many hoodies can I have in my closet, man?
The way I wear stuff, I'll be buying plenty. But Scott, I appreciate the time as always. Great stuff.
You bet. Thanks so much for having me on, Rick. Appreciate it.
Our good friend Scott Paul. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Are you hearing that? Tariffs for everybody and how wonderful it'll be? I don't think I agree, but want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day that the first minimum wage law went into effect in the United States. The first minimum wage was 25 cents an hour. The wage law was part of the Fair Labor Standards Act passed earlier that year. The act also included a mandate for a 40-hour work week and restrictions against child labor. Raising the minimum wage is one of the great political battles being fought by labor today. Since 1968, the minimum wage has not kept up with inflation. It has lost one-third of its value. Not coincidentally, the top 1% of the wealthiest people in the United States have seen their share of the nation's economy double, from 11% in 1968 to 22% in 2012. In January of 2014, 600 leading economists, including 7 Nobel Peace Prize winners, wrote an open letter to Congress and the President. They urged for the passage of an increase in the minimum wage. The letter explained, "In recent years, there have been important developments in the academic literature on the effect of increases in the minimum wage on employment. With the weight of evidence now showing that increases in the minimum wage have little or no effect on the employment of minimum wage workers, even during times of weakness in the labor market, research suggests that a minimum wage increase could have a small stimulative effect on the economy as low-wage workers spend their additional earnings, raising demand and job growth, and providing some help on the jobs front." The 1938 minimum wage law was passed at the height of the Great Depression. Labor was on the march for economic justice and fair working conditions. What will it take today to get our elected officials to raise the wage? Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You know, I got to tell you, what's amazing to me is that Joe Biden has done such a great job on the Buy American stuff. The fact that there's an office of Buy American, and I know my friend Celeste Drake is doing an amazing job over there. But that didn't happen during the Trump years. And in fact, what's interesting to me, the guy who talks the talk, again, the frame here is very simple. Donald Trump is the guy who talks the talk. There's no action behind the talk. There's no walking the walk. There's none of that. There's only the sales pitch, the con. That's what you get out of Donald Trump. Joe Biden did. And without a lot of verbiage, a lot of talking, look, you go, well, he can't. Okay, I don't care. He did. That's what's most important to me. I don't care what you say. It's what you do. And during Trump's years, I said right from the beginning, if he passes an infrastructure bill, if he got what Joe Biden got, he'd be president right now. Pandemic, it wouldn't matter. That would have superseded everything. Because the jobs that are being created because of that bill, Trump would have lived off of for he could have probably won a third term. And because of the echo chamber that the right has, they would have not missed a moment to trumpet the great work that was done from that infrastructure bill. Yet what we get out of them is it's all horrible, it's all bad, it's wasteful spending. Wasteful spending that we spend on ourselves to get us better infrastructure so we can have, you know, better internet, better opportunities, better business outcomes, better lives. And the story that's amazing to me, and I'm struggling with this one, and I've been struggling with this for a bit now, is the Bible thing. I cannot believe that hasn't sunk him. Look, I get, everyone's like, oh, he's courting the evangelical community after talking about Arnold Palmer's putter. These people, they're the ones who consume the most porn. Why am I not surprised that they would be interested in Arnold Palmer's Arnie or whatever? I understand why that wouldn't sink him. But the Bible, the Holy Bible, being printed in communist China with the American founding documents, the holy grail of democracy and faith, in some's opinion, this holy trilogy. Being printed in communist China. How has this not sunk him? How has this not been? Now, understand, the ties and the shirts and the golf stuff and the steaks and the vodka and down the list, the very long list of poor products overhyped by a really good pitchman. I understand. You fleece the flock. Get them the red hats made in China, charge them premium prices, line your pocket. He's been doing that for years. I get that. But the Bible, supposedly in the evangelical world, special. Or it should be, I think. And it should be special in the world of those people who, I carry my Bible and my Constitution. You would think that they would want those two things printed on God's chosen land. Isn't this what they tell us? And yet, $60 Bibles being printed in communist China for $3, a little under $3 a piece. You got the guy out in Oklahoma who's going to buy thousands of them to make sure that they're in every classroom in the schools. I got to tell you, I doubt he got a break on it. Now, fortunately, there are a bunch of lawsuits going on that they're going to try and stop that. I got to assume the Supreme Court in Oklahoma hasn't lost their minds. So I got to think that even just from a Bible standpoint, they're not going to allow the school district to buy that many to plaster in every classroom. And if they do, then I think they should have to put all the other religious texts there as well. But I keep coming back to those people who keep telling us how much they love their religion, how much they love their country, how special we are. How is it that didn't sink us? That didn't sink Trump? How is that possible? You don't hear anything about it. Nobody's talking about it. It's like, we expect it. It's like we expect it. And that's the scary part. We expect to get conned by the con man. And I got to tell you, this part of me goes, if it didn't happen, I think that would sink us. If he didn't screw his flock over, maybe that would sink him. Maybe they like the abuse. I don't know. I want to finish up with one more little bit. The Trump's good buddy, Vlad, evidently a Russian oligarch with ties to Vlad. Evidently, he's been found dead. Apparently, he fell from the 10th floor window of his Moscow apartment. Who knows how that happens? Who knows how, a rich guy just happens to fall out of a window? Now, evidently, his death, and this is where this gets a little bit more interesting, the latest in what they're saying, nearly a dozen other Russian energy executives who, have expired through, what was the term, mysterious circumstances over the past 2 years? Let you know a secret. Not mysterious. Not mysterious at all. We kind of know what happened. They were pushed. They were pushed. Because you don't just fall, especially if you're that wealthy. Just my thought. And here's the thing. If you hear a story that I have fallen out a window, That didn't happen. I was pushed. Because there's no way I'm jumping out a window ever. Because I don't bounce well. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. For the video, go over to freespeech.org. Find our video content over there as well with our good friends at Free Speech TV. And as always, you got something to say, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
This is Civic Media, bringing you news, talk, and community-minded conversations all across Wisconsin. You can find us at civicmedia.us and download the app for free today.